Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts. Each week at this time, H.J. Heinz Company, makers of the famous 57 varieties, gives you information, please. A quartet of experts is on hand to answer your questions. Send them to Information Please at 570 Lexington Avenue, New York 22, New York. We may edit them a bit, and in case of similarity, you'll have to accept our judgment of who shall be paid. Please note that if this year we use your question, which is postmarked any time between now and December 31st, you will get not the usual $10 in war stamps, but a $50 war bond, plus a set of the 12-volume Britannica Junior Encyclopedia. If we muff the question, you get, in addition, $57 in war bonds and stamps, plus a 24-volume set of the regular Encyclopedia Britannica. All questions remain our property. Information, Please, is presented under the supervision of Dan Golenpaul. And now, our master of ceremonies, Clifton Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Information, Please, coasts right along in his usual freewheeling manner, offering tonight as its experts the tried and true trio, John Kieran of the New York Sun, Oscar Levant, and Franklin P. Adams, together with our welcome guest, the author of the new bestseller, Taps for Private Tussie, Mr. Jesse Stewart of the Sovereign State of Kentucky. But first, a word of self-correction. On December 13th, a question submitted by Marvin Berger of this city was incorrectly answered by us, but Mr. Berger was not credited at the time with his $57 in war bonds and stamps, nor with his encyclopedia. Our mistake, and he gets them both in the next mail. And while we're on the subject of unfinished business, 2 weeks ago, we didn't have quite enough time to finish a question that came to us from Mr. Druck of New York City, who wanted to know who these people of literature were who went from one place to another in the following ways. We got the first two parts answered, one part wrongly, but not the third. Here's the third. Who went as follows? The knight went on horseback, the lady in a barge. Lady in a barge, the knight on horseback in literature.
Is that poetry or is that an author?
This happens to be poetry. Mr. Kieran?
Why, a lady of Shalott went down dying in a barge and Launcelot went on horseback.
That's
to
right.
Avalon.
Well, it's a little tough on Mr. Druck, who I'm sure was momentarily expecting to get that $57, Mr. Kieran. But that is correct, and that gives us 2 out of 3. Now, how about this first one? We'll now begin with a question from Jessica Heller of Hollis, Long Island. And this is a musical question, gentlemen. If somebody sent you the gift suggested by each of these songs, would you keep it or would you send it back? This is all in the spirit of Christmas, and let's get 2 out of 3. Let's have the first. Mr. Stewart.
Coming through the rye.
And what would you be getting in the way of a Christmas present, therefore?
I suppose a bottle of rye.
And would you keep it or send it back, Mr. Stewart?
I expect I'd keep it.
As a Kentuckian, I should think you'd keep it. Yes, coming through the rye, you'd keep. Now, how about the second one? Mr. Levant?
I'd get in trouble if I kept it, but I'd like to keep it.
What was it that you'd like
I
to keep?
I found a $1 million baby. It would involve taxes and my wife.
And not in that order, either. Yes, I found a $1 million baby in a 5 and 10 cent store. And, Mr. Adams, would you keep it?
I would keep it.
You would keep it. I guess that's safe. Now, that gives us 2 out of 3 gifts, both kept. And let's have the third. Mr. Stewart.
La Cucaracha.
La Cucaracha.
Yeah, La Cucaracha. Yes, you've got a Kentuckian kind of Spanish there.
Well, it's always been hard for me to say that word. I'm hard to say it.
And now, if you've got that in the mail, this is a Christmas gift.
I'd send it back.
You'd send it back. Yes, because you'd be getting what?
Cockroach.
A cockroach, yes. No gift for a Kentuckian or anybody else. Well, that gives us 3 out of 3. Try this one from Miss C.P. Moore of Richmond, Virginia. Approximately when do the following come to America, and from where did they come? Get 2 out of 3. The first is the potato. Mr. Stewart.
Came from South America. I think the country, it's probably Venezuela in that section.
Well, it might be in that. Is Peru anywhere near Venezuela?
Peru, or it's in that particular section.
In the Andes. It's indigenous to the Andes of Peru, and so it couldn't have come to this, to America, by which I mean both North and South America, because it was here originally. Mr. Kieran?
Well, I was only going to observe that Peru is on the other side of South America from Venezuela.
Maybe it was one of those trailing potatoes that moved.
It went back to Ireland, didn't it? And then went to Iowa and then went on a Pullman train.
It's had quite a career. But it does not come, as many people think, from Ireland. It was introduced into Ireland. How about the horse? Mr. Levant.
From Arabia, doesn't it? The ones I lost money on came from Arabia.
Mr. Kieran?
Comes from Spain. It was introduced by the Spanish conquerors.
That's quite right. About what century would that be, Mr. Kieran?
And that would be in the 16th century.
16th century is quite right. Brought over by the Spaniards. And we know about that from what interesting anecdote, Mr. Adams?
From Don Quixote.
Well, I wasn't thinking of that so much as how the boys down in Mexico greeted Cortez's men when they saw them in their saddles. They thought that it was all one animal.
They're centaurs.
Yes, they thought they were centaurs. They came together, a complete set, as it were. Now, how about ice cream? When did ice cream get here, and from where?
That's an American invention, isn't it?
No, it isn't. You would think so, Mr. Levant, but it isn't.
Well, George Washington...
Did he have ice cream?
You can't check on me now. I think he did.
Mr. Adams.
He thinks that he got it when he crossed the Delaware, but that wasn't...
that was more ice. More in the way of a sherbet. Now, ice cream was invented in Italy at the beginning of the 17th century, and then it had quite a career. It spread to France, and then to England, and then finally to the United States. Well, that gives us 2 out of 3 and sends us on to this one. Let me see. We got the horse wrong on account of Mr. Levant's impetuosity.
You don't get good ice cream in England now, I know that. Even 10 years ago. But I'm wrong, it's all
right. No. Well, that has nothing to do with the question.
No.
$57 in war bonds and stamps to Miss Moore and a set of the Britannica. And here's one from Sylvia Lesage of Dixon, Illinois. Gentlemen, I will name 4 occupations and a novelist. Now, follow me closely. You are to tell me which of the 4 occupations does not figure prominently in the novels of that author. I'll give you an example. If I should say a realtor, a doctor, decap, and then say Sinclair Lewis, which one would not figure in the novels of Sinclair Lewis? Mr. Stewart, was that your hand up?
I didn't get the question you asked, that first part there. I'm sorry.
Well, I name 4 occupations and a novelist, you see. And you were to tell me which of the 4 occupations does not figure in the novels of that author or figure prominently. Now, that was just an example. How about that example?
The sea captain's not right.
That's right. Yeah. Obviously, it doesn't figure prominently, if at all. Now, how about here are 3 sets of such. Get 2 out of 3. A farmhand, opera singer, miner, and preacher in the novels of John Steinbeck. Which doesn't appear in the novels of John Steinbeck, Mr. Levant?
The opera singer.
That's quite right. How do you figure that out?
Well, the miner... Wait, do that again, please.
Farmhand?
Farmhand is of Mice and Men.
Very good.
Yeah.
Miner?
A miner?
Yeah.
Tortilla Flat. No, there's no miner. Nobody does anything in Tortilla Flat.
It's in The Moon Is Down.
Well, that's
there
quite
is
big, yeah.
And how about a preacher?
Preacher is in The Grapes of Wrath.
That's quite right, yes. And the opera singer doesn't appear in any of the novels of John Steinbeck. How about this one? A parson, a photographer, a politician, and an artist in the novels of Nathaniel Hawthorne. Which of those does not appear? Parson, photographer, politician, artist. Mr. Kieran.
Photographer.
How do you figure that?
I don't think photography was a business when he was writing. It was quite early in the history of photography.
It was, and his character, the photographer in The House of the Seven Gables, I guess was one of the earliest photographers to be portrayed in fiction. You do lose on that one, John. Now, how about fixing up Mr. Kieran with the right answer? Which one doesn't appear in the novels of Nathaniel Hawthorne?
Say them again.
It doesn't. You don't lose anything if you guess, Mr. Adams.
We don't remember what you asked.
Parson, photographer, politician, artist.
Politician.
That's quite right.
Yeah.
Very good, Mr. Levant. A little late, but quite right. The parson, of course, is in what book?
Arthur Dimmesdale in Scarlet Letter.
Very good, Mr. Kieran. The photographer's in The House of the Seven Gables, and there's an artist in what other novel, Mr. Adams?
Probably The Marble Faun.
That's quite right. Well, you see, you could have figured it all out yourself. Well, that gives us one wrong. How about this one? Cowboy, stonecutter, scenic designer, and college professor. And the novelist is Thomas Wolfe. Which of those characters does not appear in the novels of Thomas Wolfe?
Once more, please. You do the author after the things. That's what makes it.
Mr. Stewart had his hand up on that.
Go ahead.
Well, no, I didn't get it. I would like that to be repeated.
All right, I'll give it to you again. Cowboy, stone cutter, scenic designer, and college professor.
The cowboy.
That's right, Mr. Stewart and Mr. Levant, both at once. The stone cutter is in Look Homeward Angel.
Yeah.
Where's the college professor, Mr. Stewart?
It's a...
Uptime in the River,
Uptime in the River.
And the
that stone cutter is also in a short story by Thomas Wolfe. The first one was published in Scribner's, his first published short story.
Quite right.
Well, his father was in Uptime in
the... Yes, and the scene designer was in You Can't Go Home Again. Well, that gives us 2 out of 3. Try this one from Henry Sonnebone, Jr. of Baltimore, Maryland, and again get 2 out of 3. Which of these characters, gentlemen, was real and which imaginary? The first is Baron Munchausen. Real or imaginary? Mr. Kieran.
He was real.
Right. We think of him as imaginary. When did he live, Mr. Kieran?
Oh, golly, I don't remember. Let's see, about the 17th or 18th century.
Well, that's 200 years to play around. Well, that's quite right. In the 18th century, he died in 1797. He served in the Russian army against the Turks. And how do we get the lies, the fantasies?
Well, he exaggerated. He had a flair for enlarging on the things that he'd been through.
Yes.
On the things he hadn't been through, I think.
Now, how about Paul Bunyan? Is he real or imaginary? Paul Bunyan, Mr. Stewart?
Imaginary.
Imaginary. Who is Paul Bunyan, Mr. Stewart?
Well, he was supposed to be a great lumberjack that worked in the Northwoods in Michigan.
Yeah.
And his great stories told about him that he could drink a keg of beer and the tree that he cut down and the goose that to kill was so large that it took him, I think, 50 to 200. I don't know how long it took him to cook it, and they couldn't stick a fork in it, and then it got up and flew away.
Hey, you seem to know these stories, Mr. Stewart.
Well,
they don't tell that sort of story down in Kentucky, do they?
That's before rationing that story.
We tell, similar stories, yes.
Some stories like that. How about Johnny Appleseed? Was he real or imaginary? Mr. Stewart again.
He was real.
He was indeed. Who was he?
Well, I don't know his name, but he passed through that country in southern Ohio and planted apple trees and northeast Kentucky all the way into one of the, probably Illinois or Missouri.
Indiana, I guess.
Indiana, was that?
Mr. Kieran, do you know what his real name was?
Sounds like Wendell Wilkie, no.
I don't remember. I should.
Well, he was a real man. I think he came from the state of Massachusetts, and his name was John Chapman. John Chapman. They called him Johnny Appleseed because, as Mr. Stewart reminds us, he planted apple seeds wherever he went. Well, that gives us 3 out of 3. Try this one from Mrs. A.L. Schaffer of Jamaica, Long Island. Name 3 books whose titles might help fill up a tool shed. For example, T.S. Stribling's The Forge might be such a one. Now, any titles which have something in them which would help to fill a tool shed? Mr. Kieran.
The Turn of the Screw by James.
That would be a very good one. Mr. Adams.
Plain Tales from the Hills.
Plain, yes, a plane. Very good. Mr. Levant.
I Saw France Fall.
Yeah, very good, very good. Well, that gives us 3. Any others that you can think of? Oh, there's O'Casey's The Plow and the Stars. You wouldn't have a plow in
the tool. Oh, yes, Plowman's Folly is one. It's just out, a recent book.
That's right, that would be one.
And The Anvil, let's see. Mm-hmm.
There's Alias Jimmy Valentine, a particular kind of tool shed might have that one. And How to Prepare Your Income Tax, if it was a very small tool shed. And this is a reference in fiction for our Heinz reporter, Ben Grauer. Ben, who was that certain lady who made the gravy, which was ready beforehand, piping hot, while Master Peter mashed the potatoes with incredible vigor, Miss Belinda sweetened up the applesauce, and Martha dusted the hot plates?
Well, I'll bet everybody in our audience spotted that one. It was Mrs. Cratchit who heated the gravy, and the passage you quoted tells about one of the most heartwarming feasts in all literature, Christmas dinner at the Bob Cratchits, as described by Dickens in A Christmas Carol. There's only one thing I've always missed on the Cratchit dinner menu. It's the soup. For to my way of thinking, you need soup to give the real note of festivity to a dinner. And in millions of American homes, Heinz Cream of Tomato Soup has been one of the traditional fixings of Christmas dinner for years back. You know, that's a soup that even looks like Christmas. For it has that rich red color, that deep but delicate shade that you get when you stir thick cream into a puree of luscious ripe tomatoes. And if you want to carry out that Christmas theme of red and green, you can add a generous sprinkling of chopped parsley to Heinz Cream of Tomato Soup. It will look beautiful, and it tastes... Well, stop me here, for I could go on from now till New Year's talking about Heinz Cream of Tomato Soup.
Thank you, Ben Grauer. And now try this one, gentlemen, from Miss Glow Wilson of Ottawa, Illinois. About whom was this said? Get 2 out of 3 if you can. Quote, a mind at peace with all below. Close quote. About whom was that said? That's not an easy quotation to spot. Mr. Kieran...
Yeah, I know the line, but I can't find it.
I wish I could extract that from that lovely head of yours, Mr. Kieran. It's the lady who walks in beauty in Byron's poem. Oh. She walks in beauty like the night. Mr. Stewart, did that come back to you, too, just a little too late? A mind at peace with all below, a heart whose love is innocent. The last 2 lines of Byron's poem. And try this one. About whom was this said? Oh, 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 what a girl. Mr. Levant.
Oh, 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 what a girl. If you knew Susie again. Is that right?
That's the one, yeah.
You know Susie like I know Susie. Oh, 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 what a girl. It's exaggerated.
That's the one. Susie is right. Who wrote the song, Mr. Levant?
I only know that Shapir Bernstein published it. Wait, I think I could even tell you who wrote it. Eddie Cantor used to sing it.
Buddy
that was his
DeSilva.
Big song. Huh?
Buddy DeSilva, I think.
Zary Hill. He's the head of Paramount. I apologize, DeSilva.
Even so. Now, who about whom was this said? Holy, fair, and wise is she. Mr. Kieran.
Sylvia.
Sylvia is right. Where do you find Sylvia?
You find Sylvia in a song in Shakespeare. I think perhaps it's The Two Gentlemen of Verona.
It is indeed, Mr. Kieran. And how can you give us a line or two?
Who is Sylvia? What is she that all the swains adore her? And
I can sing it.
That's bad. That's bad. Oh, we got 2 out of 3 on that. Try this one from Helen Dannelly of Holyoke, Massachusetts. Here is a question based on funeral marches, gentlemen. Who is being buried to these funeral marches? I get 2 out of 3. Here is the first. Mr. Adams?
A marionette.
That's absolutely right, Mr. Adams.
Ask him who wrote it.
Who wrote it?
Gounod.
That's right.
Hey, that's good. I don't think you're long for this
Thanks,
program,
old chap.
Matt. Gee whiz, Adams. You know, you floored the whole crowd on us. And what's the name of the composition?
Funeral March of a Marionette.
That's a perfect response. That's very good. We can't catch. All right, let's have the second one. Take that look of reflection off your face, Adams. You know you're just kidding. Mr. Levant.
Siegfried in the last act of Götterdämmerung.
Yes. Funeral March of Siegfried. Did you know that, Mr. Adams?
I never stayed for the last act of that.
I think you were wiser than Levant, Mr. Adams.
That's the best act. It's a wonderful act.
You like it, eh? The third and last now of funeral marches. Mr. Levant?
That's the second movement of the Eroica by Beethoven.
Yes.
I imagine, but I don't believe it's true, that it was originally intended to be about Napoleon, but that's nonsense.
Why couldn't it have been Napoleon, do you think, Mr. Levant?
Because they said his name was scratched out when he went too far. Beethoven was annoyed at him, and so forth and so on. But,
You don't think that legend, that story is true?
Not far as the second movement. Well, I'll get a lot of letters. I believe it. I don't believe it. No letters.
Well, it might have been Napoleon. It might have been perhaps some other hero of the time.
I just think it was
Beethoven.
A movement to follow the first movement, and
it's
it was
very
slow.
Possible. But that gives us 3 funeral marches out of 3, which is enough. Try this one for Mrs. Roland Purnell of Merchantville, New Jersey. Name 3 stories, novels, or short stories, in which one or more characters did a good job of avoiding work. Did a good job of avoiding. Mr. Adams.
Taps for Private Tussie.
Yes, so how many characters would you say in Mr. Stewart's book avoided work?
Practically all of them.
Practically all. Mr. Stewart, that's really an unusual formula for writing a bestseller. All the characters do nothing whatsoever.
Nobody worked but Stewart.
And I did on that.
I bet you did. Mr. Levant.
Well, Tobacco Row is the same type.
Yes, they don't do much working in Tobacco Road.
They eat turnips,
true.
So that's pretty hard to do.
That gives us 2. How about Mr. Huron?
The Lotus Eaters by Tennyson.
Yes, that's a nice reference. There's certainly no work done in the Lotus Eaters. Mr. Kieran, Mr. LeMond?
You can't take it with you. They don't even pay the income tax in that play.
Seems to me somebody does work and you can't take it with you.
Well, you didn't say that.
Which character doesn't?
Well, the father doesn't. Well, there's a man who works at a bank who lives there, but he's not part of the family.
Even the father goes to graduation ceremonies at Columbia, and that's sometimes work. Huckleberry Finn.
Tortilla Flat.
Tortilla Flat, yes, any of those. All very good answers. Try this one from Rebecca Simon of Brooklyn, New York. Who are these chiselers of the animal world? The first is a bird that likes to lay its eggs in the nest of another bird. Nasty creature. Mr. Stewart.
It's what we call the cowbird. I don't know the technical name for it.
The technical name is cowbird.
It is? Well, it's a cowbird because they followed my plow, and I've seen them on the other bird's nest, especially the cardinal's nest.
They do that.
They do that, yes, sir.
And now, Mr. Kieran, is there a Latin name for cowbird to help out, Mr. Stewart?
I'm not quite sure. I think it's Molothrus ater.
Take that back to Kentucky with you, Mr. Stewart. Mr. Levant?
Sometimes when we make guest shots on other shows, we lay eggs on other people's nests.
You speak for yourself, Oscar.
I speak for you, too.
Glad to have somebody speak for me on this program. Well, here's another chiseler of the animal world. This is a shellfish that takes the shells of other mollusks and discards each for a bigger one as it grows. A fine career for a shellfish. Mr. Kier.
The chambered nautilus? That uses its own. It uses its own shell.
No, well, that's not the one. And it's one that actually moves into the discarded shell of a larger cousin or brother or sister or something and stays there. What one is that?
I don't know.
It's the hermit crab.
That's right.
I believe.
That's right.
Is that right? Have you ever seen that being done, Mr. Kieran?
No, I haven't.
You find hermit crabs around our part of the country?
I think you do.
I imagine. How about a bird that moves in when a rodent moves out? Mr. Kieran.
That is the owl of the desert, the Arizona desert, the burrowing owl.
That's right.
It moves into the deserted nests of prairie dogs. But don't ask me to give you that Latin name because it's very complicated.
No, I won't ask you for that. That gives us 2 out of 3. And now here's a different type of question. It seems that there's an ancient Swedish custom that promises to find wide acceptance in this country. And since it's connected with eating, our Heinz reporter, Ben Grauer, should be able to tell us about it. Take over, Ben.
Well, in Sweden, it's the custom on Christmas Eve for everybody in the household, servants and all, countesses and cooks, to share a buffet supper in the kitchen. Well, that's a fine idea, because in most homes, there isn't much time to fuss about dinner the night before Christmas. There are the last packages to be wrapped, the finishing touches to go under the tree, and the neighbors all dropping in to say hello, so you get the kitchen all slicked up and shining. And then you all gather around the kitchen table, and you help yourself to cold meats and hot breads or sandwiches or baked beans. And best of all, you fill your bowl clear to the top with a big steaming ladleful of Heinz cream of tomato soup. Now there's a soup that rounds out a supper. Heinz cream of tomato soup is light and delicate in color and flavor, but it has real body to it because it's made with plenty of rich, heavy cream. And the seasoning is masterly. That's the only word for it. Heinz cooks add their spices according to a recipe that was old and tried and true when your grandfather was young. You'll want to have Heinz cream of tomato soup on hand for your holiday meals, so make a note of it on tomorrow's shopping list.
Thank you, Ben Grauer. Now try this one for Miss Frances Klein of Essington, Pennsylvania. Identify these American poets from their careers. The first was a Quaker, a bookkeeper, a slipper maker, and a journalist. Who was he? Mr. Stewart.
Whittier.
That's right. First names? What was his first name?
John Greenleaf Whittier.
We like first names on this program. Now, how about one who was a scene shifter, a harvest hand, a biographer, and a newspaper man? An American poet? Mr. Stewart again.
Whittier, Walt Whitman.
Now, you have to prove that one by me.
Was he
ever a harvest hand? I don't think so.
I guess I'm right.
Wrong.
He was. Was he ever a biographer?
No.
No. Was he ever a scene shifter?
Sorry.
We've only got 1 out of 4 on that one. He was a newspaper man, that's right. Now, the answer, Mr. Adams?
It might be Bryant. He was a newspaper man.
He was, and he was a biographer, too. I don't think he was either a scene shifter or a harvest hand, Mr. Kieran. No,
was it Franklin P. Adams?
Oh, he worked on a farm, but I don't know that he ever was a scene shifter.
Adams, did you
Franklin say? P. Adams was a newspaper man, a scene shifter, as of now. And what else?
A harvest hand.
Well, he has a farm.
He has a farm, but somebody else does the work for him. Mrs. Adams, as a matter of fact. No, it's Carl Sandburg. Carl Sandburg has been all of those things. That gives us one wrong. And how about this? Here's a poet who's been a lawyer, a magazine editor, a soldier, and a librarian. Who is that?
Harry Hopkins. No, I'm sorry. He was a librarian.
He's not a poet.
No.
Mr. Stewart.
It's the one in the Library of Congress now that wrote Conquistador.
MacLeish?
Archibald MacLeish.
Archibald MacLeish. Did you mean your answer seriously?
No, of course not. No, I mean it seriously. I didn't.
You mean it seriously?
It was a bad joke.
Sorry, you confuse me sometimes. Not often. I'll accept your answer then. Mr. Stewart is quite right. Archibald MacLeish, now the head of the Library of Congress. And that gives us 2 out of 3. Try this one from Anthony Lutrario of Providence, Rhode Island. Here's a very interesting question, particularly for People who like Mr. Adams and Mr. Stewart are professional poets. And even Mr. Kieran, I think, tosses a stave around occasionally. From the style, can you identify this contemporary poet? I'll just read a few lines from him or her. See if you can get, just from the style, who it is. Feed the grape and bean to the vintner and munger. I will lie down lean with my thirst and my hunger. Mr. Adams.
That's Edna St. Vincent Millay.
That's quite right, Mr. Adams. Would you be able to tell it if you didn't know those four lines, do you think?
I think so.
I think you would, too. Where are those lines from, by the way? See, you don't know, and that proves that you got it just from the style. Well, it's from The Harp Weaver and other poems, a poem called Feast by Edna St. Vincent Millay. Now, try this one. Meaningless as wind in dry glass or rat's feet over broken glass. Mr. Stewart.
I think that's Carl Sandburg.
No.
Can I take a guess?
You bet, Mr. Yes,
doesn't necessarily have to. Is it T.S. Eliot?
It is. That's
how
quite
do you
right.
like that?
I like that very well indeed. Very
and
good.
And I wasn't fooling. He's
no,
my favorite poet. I read four lines of his once.
That's swell for Eliot.
The four quartets, the last quartets.
Gee, I wish you'd come in just a second before Mr. Stewart.
Well, I didn't, so what?
Well, I'll have to count that wrong, although the second guess of Mr. Levant's, which was not a guess at all, I think he really knew it, is right. T.S. Eliot, Hollow Men is the poem from which it comes. Try this one. Tooting hope, tooting hope, tooting hope, tooting hope, willy, 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 wahoo. Mr. Adams.
If that isn't Gertrude Stein, I want my money back.
You know, it might very well be, but it isn't. It isn't. Mr. Kieran?
That fellow who goes around playing the banjo, isn't it? He wrote a book here not so long ago, about a year or within 2 years.
No, this poet's been dead quite a few years.
Well, then it isn't my friend.
Mr. Adams?
Rachel Lindsay.
Yes, that's the one, Mr. Adams. Awfully sorry you came in late on that. And no, that's much better than anything Miss Stein ever wrote, really. That gives us two wrong out of three and sends $57 in war bonds and stamps to Mr. Lutrario. Yes, Mr.?
I know of Gertrude Stein is better than that. I go there regularly every day. Every day I go there regularly.
You think that's better than that?
I like that.
You fight it out with Adam. Believe me, there's very little to choose between those quotations, but I think I prefer Mr. Lindsay's. By the way, do you know what poem that comes from, Mr. Adams? Something called the Calliope Yell. He pronounces it Calliope. I don't know whether that's right, Mr. Kieran. Should it be Calliope?
Not nice circle.
That's right about a circus.
I guess it is right about a circus. Well, that gives us two wrong and sends $57, as before said, and I guess that's all we'll have time for. Thank you, Mr. Stewart, for the aid and assistance tonight. This evening, the H.J. Hines Company has paid out $114 in war bonds and stamps and two sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Next week, along with Mr. Kieran and Mr. Adams, Information Please will present two favorite information pleasers, the well-known news commentator, Mr. Leon Henderson, and the versatile poet, novelist, and lecturer, Miss Jan Struther. Remember...